Hello and welcome to the OnFIF podcast, a weekly discussion on key trends in investment and economic policy from some of the world's leading commentators. On this week's episode, we talk about the ECB decision in January 2019. What are some of the implications? My name is Martin Stepan. I'm the Deputy Head of Meetings here at OnFIF, calling in from London. And today I'm delighted to be joined by Professor Volkan Wieland, the Managing Director at the Institute for Monetary and Financial Stability and member of the German Council of Economic Experts. Welcome.
Thank you.
So as we look to tomorrow's big ECB decision, the IMF, it's lowered its 2019 forecast for the euro area in terms of growth to about 1.6%. Core inflation is around 1% and headline prices should come down with recent oil price declines. A slowing German economy, the gilets jaunes in France, Brexit, Italian political uncertainties, plus trade uncertainties in the US, and yet the ECB sees risks as broadly balanced and hence perhaps about rate increases after the summer. Can we expect a change of assessment to these downside risks? Should there be more emphasis placed on monetary policy accommodation?
Well, I think you have to look at the overall picture, not just the recent incoming data. The overall picture has been one of the euro area economy growing above potential for several years now. And that means that the level of output is also reaching a level above the potential as it is, for example, estimated by the European Commission. And at the same time, over the last 2 years, we've seen increases in inflation, and there are several measures of inflation. The target is for overall inflation. That's 2%. Core has always been for a long time somewhat below, but we're not far from target at all. On the other hand, monetary policy has remained in crisis modus, right? We have negative interest rates. We have a very large balance sheet, which has been increasing until recently, until end of December. So we're far away in terms of monetary policy from any point one could regard as neutral. But the economy overall has moved close to potential inflation, close to target growth rates, above potential growth rate. So it's high time to change monetary policy, to actually have an actual turn going towards a tightening modus or at least removing accommodation. And that hasn't even happened yet.
Can we expect a change to the guidance in terms of the rates will stay on hold through the summer?
Well, so as I said, first, that was my assessment of the overall picture. The recent incoming data puts the ECB under some pressure to explain. I think they should take the road to explain as I did. They may do a different road, right? They may very well. And if you ask me to forecast or try to predict what the ECB might do, which is not easy, I wouldn't be surprised if they more and more get into talking, pushing off the increase in policy rates they perceive. But I would not necessarily expect this to happen now at the upcoming meeting, because so far the data is pretty mixed and some of the reaction to the recent incoming data may have been too negative in the press, in the market circles.
Do we have any perhaps expectation to know when would the ECB expect inflation to move higher itself?
Well, what the ECB expects, we don't know, because the Governing Council doesn't produce a forecast. There's no Governing Council forecast like at the Bank of England or the Bank of Norway or other central banks. We have a staff forecast, and the staff forecast hasn't changed much. If you looked at December, that's the last time they do it quarterly. That's the last time we got a forecast. So there was a little bit of readjustment, but it was very much along the lines of the fall and summer. So, you know, a little bit up for the current year, a little bit down for the next year, but moving up towards target. So that in itself, the forecast of the ECB staff, I don't think gives any reason for the ECB now to somehow go back to even more policy accommodation.
So what would be some of the key things that you'd be looking out to hear tomorrow's announcements?
Well, I think there will be a discussion of the risks, how to interpret the data. There is a number of reasons why growth is slowing down. First of all, if an economy has been growing above potential for several years, you'd expect it to moderate. And if you have more than 30% of the euro area is Germany, which has been in this situation for a while and clearly has an overutilization a situation of overutilization of capacity. So you would expect some moderation. Then you had some special effects, you know, I mean, quite shocking, I would say, but say, for example, the car industry in Germany not preparing for new emission standards, stopping production in the fall. That has really affected the third quarter. It will affect the fourth quarter to some extent. We don't know yet whether the fourth quarter will be positive or negative. Statistical office has in its press conference, though they haven't released the fourth quarter estimate, it sounds like it will be flat or slightly positive. So that's a special effect. And on top of that, you have the two or three international important risks. You have the ongoing trade war, rise in protectionism coming primarily from President Trump. The overall measures have not been that, in terms of magnitude, have not been that important. But, you know, this does have an effect on confidence, on perceptions, may lead companies to postpone setting up new production lines or other kinds of investment. That certainly affects economies such as Germany, which produce for manufacturing in particular and export internationally. And then, of course, you have the problem that we're moving towards a hard Brexit. You know more about that in London or may have a better assessment, but that's becoming a bigger risk. And that certainly would be a bad thing for the UK. It would be also not a good thing for the euro area, not a good thing for Germany. That's another risk. And finally, Italy is going into a self-created crisis by the government trying to live over its means and thereby risk premia rising, and that's affecting the economy in Italy. So that Italy is going counter the rest of the euro area in terms of its development. And the risk premia rising for the government means risk premia rising for banks, meaning risk premia rising for companies. We just saw the banks getting into trouble. Then the government decides to bail them out. That raises its debt further. Not a good strategy. But the ECB can't do multi-policy for one country. They have to look at the euro area as a whole, and that is looking quite good and certainly not calling for a crisis multi-policy.
Thank you. From the minutes of the last ECB meeting in December, policymakers, they showed some interest in there's debate about the new multi-year loans to banks to be used as a stimulus tool. As a way of navigating the fragile and fluid global context. Has the weak data in a way encouraged, would the ECB start discussing new multi-year loans and under what conditions could the ECB, in a sense, provide new LTROs?
Well, first of all, so President Draghi has been asked in the press conference last time about this, and it's been pretty vague that this is something they're discussing. So, like, you know, they always discuss their instruments. So I can't give you any view on what I think they might be likely to discuss or do in that regard. But what I can tell you is what I think would need to be done or not need to be done. I don't see, for example, any need whatsoever to start getting in the business of targeted long-term refinancing operations with a fixed rate. The TLTROs we've had. I mean, they are crisis mode instruments because they promise fixed rates for a long horizon. No need in the current economic situation to get into that. And if there are banks who'd love that, those are probably banks in trouble, and we have other instruments to deal with them. You know, we've created a banking union. We have the SRM, we have the SRF, the fund, we have the methodology and proceedings to restructure our banks. So then that should be used for those banks, not keep them alive with long-term refinancing. As we actually move into raising rates, there might be a situation you might consider long-term refinancing operation tied to these rising rates. But I think the case to be made there's been a strong case to be made, and I think that's hard at this point. The kind of problems we have, for example, in Italy, we have other instruments for them. Well, that's why banking union was created. That's why the single resolution mechanism was created, and they've done their job already on other banks. If anything, the problem there is that governments are too willing to use the exceptions in the system, which ultimately lead to the taxpayer bailing out these banks. So we should work on that front more. But per se, I think long-term refinancing operations, which are tied to the market or to the policy rate as it rises, that's less of a concern. In the past, the ECB always did longer-term refinancing operations up to 1 year. That was nothing new. The new thing in 2011 was the three-year operation, back then the bazooka. At the time, its effect was give banks a lot of leeway to invest in government debt. We don't need that now either. You know, there's no need to give Italian banks 3 years cheap central bank financing so they invest that in Italian government debt. That's not helpful. Rather, what we need is some more stricter rules for government debt, such as, for example, introducing capital charges, so that banks properly assess the risk associated with holding government debt.
You mentioned balance sheets, and obviously this is the first time in 4 years that the ECB will not be increasing its holding of government bonds. Have we seen any movements in the markets to be able to determine sort of the first signs of any consequences of ECB's decision in December?
Well, first of all, just to put it in perspective, I mean, the decision was simply to stop the increase in purchases of government debt. The ECB will remain a major player in those markets. So because their debt matures, they will reinvest it in those same countries' debt. So from a purely market perspective, you know, do I find a buyer for any debt I've acquired, or, you know, is the ECB remaining as a strong buyer in that market? That definitely will be the case because they have a huge portfolio now and they've promised to keep it even longer at that level than postponing rate increases, right? So you look at a long period where they will remain in that situation. So I don't think there is any particular risk for markets. Fortunately, the ECB is not stepping up purchases. It's not needed for macro purposes. And also they're reaching the limits, their self-imposed limits, and the intention of those limits, issue share limits. The intention was that they would not by themselves have a blocking vote in any restructuring of government debt. If they reach that point by default, I think they would be required to block, and thereby they would make it impossible if we ever get another crisis. And if the European Stabilization Mechanism, the ESM, if it wants to help a country and in the context of that restructure some of the debt, the ECB would have to vote against it. So these limits are useful, and the ECB should not go over them. If anything, they should use the positive developments in the euro area economy, and by which I don't mean the recent data. I mean the overall perspective we had for a number of years. They should have used that, or should use that going forward, to reduce their balance sheet. And so if you think forward, if you think beyond the time of the first interest increase, I think they should start bringing back the balance sheet, just like the US did. And that will reduce their exposure to governments. You know, governments can get ideas. We had the Italian members of the government, the current government, occasionally voice ideas how they could default on some of the debt held by the Bank of Italy. Not a pretty picture. On the other hand, if you look at this overall quantitative easing, the role of these direct purchases, I think they're most effective in a crisis when you have a real crisis situation, just as like we had 2009 or then in the government debt crisis 2011, 2012. We're not in such a crisis. And so I don't expect at all the same effect from reducing the balance sheet, which you got from, say, increasing the balance sheet in 2009.
There is some concern when we look at the implication from the trade war, and you start looking at some data that's coming out from the US in terms of potential recession. And at this stage, because of the sequencing of the ECB's decisions, that in a way that it may lack the tools to be able to adequately deal with some of these challenges.
The ECB has a variety of tools. You already mentioned it. They can do long-term refinancing operations. They can do targeted long-term refinancing operations. They could go more negative on the rate still a little bit. And they could, of course, buy more assets. I just don't think it's a good idea to buy more assets, and I don't think it's needed. But they're not without instruments. But on a broader perspective, this idea that one could run out of room to ease is an important one. And it generally calls for removing policy accommodation in good times and easing in bad times. And since we had a period of several years of growth above potential, we have actual GDP above estimates of potential now, we are in a good period. And so it's a period for removing policy accommodation. Of course, if you never remove policy accommodation, it may cause problems in other areas. Over-exaggerated asset prices is just one example. Risk on bank balance sheets is another one. And so you don't end up in a good position for the next downturn. I don't think we can say with any confidence that the next downturn is around the corner. Generally, what we can say is that growth should slow for a number of reasons, and part of that, a big part of that, is normalization, return to potential, or actually the level of GDP returning to potential. If you look at the U.S., absolutely, I think trade war is a risk, and don't just look at the U.S., U.K., Brexit is a big risk, particularly for the U.K., hard Brexit, but also for the euro area. I think, personally, I think actually if we go down that route, I would suggest for the European Commission and leaders to come up with something which may make it easier to have a negotiated Brexit, maybe on the Irish question, but that's a different topic. But that's a big risk. I don't see the U.S. economy around for the next recession. I mean, more likely the U.K. The U.S. has had a major tax reform, which is a major stimulus. I think overall that's a good idea. Eventually they will have to constrain expenditure because that's running too high due to, for example, health expenditure on the health system and health insurance, government contributions to that. But basically, I don't see that causing a recession at this point. I mean, there's no confidence you could put into that at this point. Now, the government shutdown is another problem. I hope President Trump actually stops this. It's up to him. I mean, there are compromises available.
Do you see a situation where the ECB could actually reintroduce the quantitative easing?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you have inflation dropping down, if you have the economy in the euro area tanking, I would not be surprised at all if the ECB uses asset purchases as an additional measure to counter that. I just don't think that's the situation we're in. We're in a different situation, and we should not lose sight of that because of some recent negative data.
You mentioned Brexit obviously being a key risk. How well prepared can you say the EU and ECB is in terms of being able to deal with a no-deal Brexit?
I think the ECB is well prepared. I mean, there are not many areas they have to prepare. I mean, I think they can do their multi-policy either way. I think they have their counterparties. The UK is not part of the euro. So in that sense, the main question for the ECB is how well are the banks prepared? Should they expect any restriction in credit for the euro area? I don't think that's the case. The main risk there is that countries exposed to trade, such as Germany, will have a negative effect on their export industry. That's the biggest issue, I think, in terms of GDP assessing the impact on euro area GDP. There are some issues regarding derivative trades and other things, but I think also at some time President Draghi made a statement that he thinks banks have enough time to prepare for all these contingencies, right? I mean, they cannot forecast. It's very hard to forecast what will happen at this point, but the contingencies are pretty clear. And so you have to, of course, prepare for the worst case contingency. And so banks have to prepare for being able to honor all the trades they're in, you know, and deal with any counterparty risks that might be arising in trading platforms. But there's enough. There has been now a lot of time to prepare for that. So I'd be quite shocked if they didn't. But on the other hand, can't really make preparations to completely offset any negative impact from hard Brexit. So, for example, of course, if for a while trade slows down because new rules have to be found or because trucks are stopped at the border, you can, to some extent, build up stocks. That's probably what's been happening. I mean, I don't know. Probably if you're living in the UK, maybe you're building up stocks of all kinds of items. But that has costs in itself. One might even say, to some extent, that process is going on because of fears of a hard Brexit. It's already introducing negative effects, which will play out either way.
This year is very critical in terms of the ECB leadership and various changeovers, various candidates who we mentioned who would be likely to replace Mario Draghi in October. Jens Weidmann and Benoît Cœuré are some of the people who've been mentioned. What's your take? Who do you think is going to be?
Absolutely, there are several leadership changes. I mean, the most important one, as you say, is the presidency, but also the chief economist, or at least Peter Pratt, then leaving earlier this year. And then either someone on the board has to take on the role of chief economist, or whoever is newly appointed will take on that role. The president has leeway to decide about the distribution of tasks among the board members. I think it remains interesting. It's not clear who will take on that role. In terms of the presidency and the other role, I think it's high time to have economists in those positions. I mean, Peter Pratt is a PhD economist. Mario Draghi is a PhD economist. We have several lawyers on the ECB board. We have several people with a primarily political background, like the vice president. So we certainly need economists there, not have the number decrease further. For the president's position, I think it would be very helpful to have someone who has been in the governing council. That would mean possibly one of the bank presidents. And then finally, you know, this is Europe. Europe is made up of many nations, and on all these European appointments, nationality plays a role no matter where. And we did have a Dutch president, we did have a French president, we had an Italian president. Now we're having an Italian president, so it makes sense to give some more attention to potential candidates from other countries. And all those three aspects taken together, you know, would suggest Jens Weidmann is a very good candidate, right? Because he's an economist, he's been on the governing council for a while. He's not from France or from Italy or from the Netherlands. So I think he's a strong candidate who should be considered. There are some other candidates being talked about, primarily because there's this perception, because now there's a German candidate for the European People's Party, which brings together the Christian Democrat parties around Europe, Manfred Weber, he's a candidate, and there's the new idea that the candidate who wins the most votes in this election with his Spitzenkandidat, right? I think they even used the German term, that person should become commission president, like Jean-Claude Juncker, or Jean-Claude Juncker's successor. And then there's the perception, oh, if that person is German, then you can't have an EZB president who's German. I think that discussion is too far ahead. That's my personal assessment. I think, well, let's see what happens in those elections. Let's see if then who is really appointed then president of the commission. Manfred Schulz wasn't, for example. But in any case, I think Weidmann is a good candidate. There are others talked about, right, from smaller countries.
For example, Olli Rehn.
Yeah, Philip Lane has talked also a lot about for the successorship of Peter Pratt. So he's also someone with a background, an economic background as economist. So that prior to becoming governor of the Irish Central Bank, so maybe that brings this academic research perspective into, which is a useful one for that, the responsibilities Peter Pratt has right now. We'll have to see. So I think he's a more likely candidate for that, but who am I to say? You know, I don't know. It's still very uncertain. We'll see how it plays out with the European elections.
Well, there's certainly a lot to be looking forward to both tomorrow and for the rest of the year. Thank you very much, Volker, for speaking with us today. It's been very, very interesting, and we look forward to seeing what the developments will bring. Thank you for listening to our podcast. If you've enjoyed the program, then please do leave us a review.